about you when she set up this meeting for me. She told me that I would be sorry that I ever asked her to set this up, because she said you are a real bitch. She was wrong. You're an effing bitch. So with that, they all got up and walked right out of the White House. Gary, could this really be true? Is Hillary that screwed up? Screwed up? That's a matter of opinion. Tightly wound? Ready to pounce on enemies, real and imagined? Abusive of White House staff? That I had on good authority. One White House staffer, who must obviously remain anonymous, told me a story that was typical Hillary. At midnight, hours before a long-planned overseas trip, Hillary Clinton called the usher's office and ordered 3 tubes of Blistex. The assistant usher tried gently to tell the First Lady that the White House pantry and supply room did not maintain a drugstore. He didn't get very far. Suffice it to say, ears still ringing, the assistant usher drove around Washington in his own car looking for an all-night drugstore, bought the Blistex with his own money, and was neither thanked nor reimbursed by the First Lady. Mrs. President doesn't seem to know how to moderate her behavior, even when she's among friends. A senior permanent employee, who I knew to be a strong supporter of the Clintons, had looked forward to meeting her. He held a position that ensured that someday he would. One day he saw Hillary Clinton walking in his direction down a corridor in the OEOB. She looked in no particular hurry, so he thought it might be a good time to say hello. She approached with her Secret Service agents walking several paces behind her. Working up his best smile, he said, "Good morning, Mrs. Clinton." She stared right through him. He told me it was as if she had pierced his skull with laser beams. My friend still works at the White House, and I cannot use his true name for very obvious reasons. He has a family to feed. But he told me he recovered and walked on down the hall, dumbstruck. He knew Barbara Bush. That day, he learned that Hillary Clinton is no Barbara Bush. Another staffer, also permanent, witnessed the event from her cracked office door and approached my friend. "John, I guess you didn't get the word." "What word?" "When Queen Hillary walks down the hall, you're not supposed to look at her. You're actually supposed to go into an office if there is one nearby. She doesn't want staff seeing her. And I know she sure as hell doesn't want to meet you or any other staffer." "You have to be kidding me." "No, we got the word in a staff meeting. It's true. Look around. Do you see anyone else in the hall?" John looked around, and sure enough, people were starting to emerge like prairie dogs peeking out of their burrows after a hawk has flown past. My partner Dennis had a similar experience. In February 1993, he was walking to the residence to interview head usher Gary Walters about a new employee. He saw Hillary Clinton coming from the opposite direction. She was carrying a box that appeared to be heavy, and she was about to come to a double door that would have been hard to open even if she had not been carrying a heavy box. He noticed the Secret Service agents making no effort to assist her. He stepped forward to help. But a resident staffer close enough to Dennis to whisper without being heard by Queen Hillary said, "Don't." When Hillary was safely away, the staffer told Dennis that Hillary insisted that no man should assist her in any way. Another close source, this one in the Secret Service, told me that Hillary had ordered her Secret Service protective detail to stay the F away from me, and to keep at least 10 yards of distance between her and them at all times. The Secret Service agent told me that it was much harder to protect her from a distance of 10 yards, and she was told this, but she didn't seem to care what the Secret Service said. He also told me that it was obvious that she had a clear dislike for the agents, bordering on hatred, in his opinion. Along those same lines, another source reports that 2 Secret Service agents heard Hillary's daughter Chelsea refer to them as personal trained pigs to some of her friends. When the friends had gone, the senior agent on the detail tried to scold Chelsea for such disrespect. He told her that he was willing to put his life on the line to save hers, and he believed that her father, the president, would be shocked if he heard what she had just said to her friends. Chelsea's response? "I don't think so. That's what my parents call you." In a way, that Chelsea story didn't surprise me, because Hillary Clinton's roots were deep in the 1960s counterculture, where equating law enforcement officers with pigs was commonplace. I knew that as a college student, Hillary had made the cover of Time magazine as an example of student radicalism. She had also attended the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in 1968, where the Radical Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, and others had orchestrated the Days of Rage riots, chanting "Death to the pigs" while throwing bags of human excrement at the police. After graduating from Yale, Hillary Rodham was invited to the House Judiciary Committee, where she worked with Bernard Nussbaum in the effort to impeach President Nixon. That effort was led by Congressman Thomas P. Tip O'Neill, who went on to become Speaker of the House. To make his case for impeaching Nixon, O'Neill built a 718-page report, researched and written by the legal staff on the House Judiciary Committee. This document provided the rationale for allowing the committee to continue its work, to subpoena and subpoena, until eventually they acquired the Nixon tapes, which became the basis for 3 articles of impeachment. Without the 718-page report, it is quite possible, as O'Neill related in his memoirs, Man of the House, that his impeachment efforts would have been stalled. Much of the research and writing of this book was done by none other than Hillary Rodham and her mentor, supervisor, and close personal friend, Bernard Nussbaum. In First in His Class, David Moranis describes the relationship between Hillary and Bernie as close. He points out that both Nussbaum and Rodham worked night and day, 7 days a week, on the effort to impeach Nixon. Rodham was known to refer to Nixon as evil, especially with reference to his politics. Strictly speaking, comments like that would have violated her oath of office as a Judiciary Committee lawyer, who is supposed to be objective. But how objective could Hillary be? After graduating from Yale Law School, she and her live-in boyfriend, Bill Clinton, had worked on the McGovern presidential campaign. Moreover, she and Nussbaum reportedly made no pretense that their purpose working on the committee was to get Nixon. According to Moranis' sources, the impeachment staff experience was much like that of a political campaign, or, in other words, an extra-electoral means of ousting the man who had defeated Bill and Hillary's candidate for president. Now Hillary was herself in the White House. Her Watergate mentor was White House counsel, and they showed they'd learned some important lessons from their past experiences. In his book, Tip O'Neill observes, "Those tapes are what undid Nixon. If he had destroyed them, he could have remained in office until the end of his second term. And not to destroy them was irrational." In 1973, Rodham and Nussbaum worked overtime to get those tapes. In 1993, 20 years later, Nussbaum, while defending his decision to forbid FBI agents from searching the dead Vince Foster's office, said, "A smart New York lawyer would have made the documents disappear before the subpoenas arrived." Maybe that's why President Clinton let his wife choose his lawyers for him. He certainly seemed to have no qualms about having her choose much of his staff and run much of the government for him as well. One day, while Dennis was waiting to interview Mac McLarty, he overheard McLarty's executive assistant talking to another assistant. "Do you think she'll get away with it?" "Well, if she doesn't, it'll be the first time she's lost a battle around here." "I don't know what she's trying to do. If we route all of McLarty's incoming and outgoing mail through her office, it's just going to create another step and delay things even worse." "Yeah, but Hillary wants to see who's coming in to see Mac and what he's reading and writing and working on. She wants to control this office. That's the long and the short of it. Hillary is trying to be the chief of staff." "I guess we should just get ready for it, since nobody around here seems to know how to say no to Hillary." Traditionally, the First Lady's role is dominated by running the domestic side of the White House. But by becoming de facto chief of staff, or more accurately, co-president, Hillary not only ran the domestic side of the White House, she ran domestic policy as well. Some of this was done by high-level staff appointments, such as putting her law firm partners Vince Foster and Bill Kennedy in the counsel's office, and making her good friend Carol Rasko director of the Office of Domestic Policy. But Mrs. Clinton was also the de facto White House counsel and director of presidential personnel, selecting and clearing staff. There were some staff members with obvious links to the president, like Catherine Cornelius and another West Wing employee, both young, attractive blondes. But the president generally kept a low profile in the staffing and management of the White House. I saw no evidence of a power struggle between the president and the first lady. The power was all hers. The president's role seemed limited to taking the blame. Most of the staff was linked to Hillary, and in many cases she approved of new hires only after interviewing them personally. Indeed, in Elizabeth Drew's book, On the Edge, it was reported that Hillary attended personnel selection and placement meetings about 80% of the time. Evidently, Mrs. Clinton was also responsible for the personnel decisions made by the transition team. There was a clearance process for White House employees. They had to be approved by Hillary. And Hillary, if my thousands of interviews were representative, had an affirmative action program that favored tough, minority, and lesbian women, as well as weak, minority, and gay men. It was also apparent that when Hillary wanted a candidate, character issues were brushed aside. That might sound broad brush. It is. But it is justifiable. I know. I was there. If you compared the staffers of the Bush administration with those of the Clinton administration, the difference was shocking. It was Norman Rockwell on the one hand, and Berkeley, California, with an Appalachian twist, on the other. In the Bush administration, Deputy Counsel John Schmitz reviewed the FBI spin investigations. Schmitz made his recommendations to the president's counsel, Boyden Gray. Gray would weigh Schmitz's recommendation and sign off on the final paperwork that would allow a White House staff member a security clearance and a permanent pass. If, during the course of the spin investigation, or perhaps earlier, in the pre-FBI scrubbing that could give early warnings of unsuitability, serious issues were developed and proven, then the president's counsel would tell the president that Joe Blow wouldn't be joining the White House staff. If the president asked why, he would be told that there was a problem in the FBI investigation. President Bush would never have asked, "Can we ignore it or get around it?" That would have been ridiculous. How did I know that? Because I personally handled investigations of persons President Bush wanted for particular slots. And when these persons couldn't get through the FBI investigation, they were immediately dropped from further consideration. In the Clinton administration, things were very different. The function of approving and issuing security clearances and permanent passes was done in a loose and dangerous way. To start with, the authority to grant passes was delegated down from Bernard Nussbaum, the counsel, to Vince Foster, his deputy, to Bill Kennedy, the associate counsel, and in many cases from Kennedy down to Craig Livingstone, who was the director of the security office, but who was not an attorney and had no security experience. I learned that all of these individuals were hand-picked for their respective roles by Hillary Clinton. Other major changes were made, the most significant being the deletion of character as a component to determine suitability. No attempt was ever made to dismiss a staffer after he or she had been selected by Hillary or Bill Clinton, no matter what character problems one might find. During a conversation with Elizabeth Drew in February 1993, Communications Director George Stephanopoulos explained it this way. "We've learned about the power of the president's voice. When he says something, it pretty much drives everything else away." This was Stephanopoulos' explanation for the Zoe Baird and Kimba Wood fiascos. What he didn't admit was what we all eventually knew, that choosing the attorney general was Hillary's prerogative. Hillary had been told that Baird and Wood had problems, but she didn't care. She wanted them, and that was that. If the Clinton White House had had a real counsel with real authority, these two nominations would have been vetted by attorneys knowledgeable about background investigations and suitability. When Baird and Wood caused such trauma to the Clinton administration, Nussbaum and Foster didn't get the blame because they hadn't made the decision. Hillary had. The Clintons and their staff did not have a reputation for being good listeners, but they did have a reputation for losing their tempers. The President and Mrs. Clinton, especially, were frequently observed flying into rages at each other or at staffers. They evidently thought this was a healthy and constructive way to air differences, but it had the inevitable effect of creating chaos and cowardice in the White House, not to mention lots of shouting, which ensured that bad personnel choices initiated from the top were never questioned. This made me wonder what the working atmosphere at the Rose Law Firm of Hillary Clinton, Vince Foster, William Kennedy, and Webster Hubbell must have been like. In any event, the Rose Law Firm certainly has left its mark on Washington with a suicide, several scandals. Hubbell, for one, is today peeling potatoes in a federal penitentiary, and Hillary's seizure of power, which might extend even to the humble halls of the FBI. Evidence has surfaced to suggest that Judge Sessions' replacement, Louis Free, like every other important Clinton presidential appointment, was made by Hillary, in collaboration with Bernard Nussbaum, Susan Thomason, and Vince Foster. But the picture is murkier than that. Among those recommending Louis Free for FBI director was Robert Fisk. Free was appointed in July 1993. On 20 January 1994, Fisk was appointed special counsel to investigate the Clintons' involvement with Whitewater. Fisk's investigators are on loan from the FBI. Obviously, the potential for conflict of interest is rife in this web of mutual friends. Although there is no evidence of misconduct on the part of these agents, they should never have been put in this situation in the first place. There is a word for what is missing here, and it's ethics. Ethics were something the Bush administration took great pains to enforce. Advising the Bush administration on day-to-day ethics questions was, in fact, the prime responsibility of Associate Counsel Greg Walden. This emphasis on ethics by President Bush was evidently not shared by the new administration, whose co-presidents, interestingly enough, were both lawyers. There was still the matter of the social side, the domestic side, of the White House. In past presidencies, this large function took the full-time effort of the First Lady and about 20 fine staff members, as well as a number of volunteers and a long list of helpers who could be available to come down to the White House and help out as needed. The residence itself was a major operation. It was well managed by Chief Usher Gary Walters, but certain major decisions had to be made by the First Lady. Hiring, firing, promotions of resident staffers, and the style of food served in the residence were prerogatives of the First Lady. In the world of Hillary, it might take a village to raise a child, but it takes only one hard-driven Rose Law Firm partner to run the entire government. It quickly became evident, however, that the First Lady's traditional functions were beyond Mrs. Clinton. The first warning signs came shortly after the inauguration. Janet Green was a Clinton administration employee who, like many others, didn't know where she would be assigned to work. She ended up as an assistant to David Watkins. When I met her, I recall her demeanor as polite, but not overly serious. Green had the Clinton administration smirk that many staffers had when they met an FBI agent. I could not imagine Green being put in charge of evaluating serious functions at the White House, but she was. Ms. Green's job was to interview personnel in each of the offices she was assigned to examine, and after she had sized up whatever White House operation she was studying, she was to report back to Hillary and tell her what she had found. Based on her report, staffing needs would be addressed. It was late December, and although a new president was about to take office, and one would expect general chaos to reign in the White House, much of the White House continued to hum along as always, because many of its functions were not political. The visitor's office was one such apolitical function, Although not long after they took office, the Clintons politicized the visitor's office, too, by withholding tours requested by members of Congress, thus punishing them if they had not voted for the president's agenda. The visitor's office is located in the East Wing, on the first floor just under the First Lady's suite of offices. During the Bush administration, the office was headed by Director Janet Johnson. I knew most of the staff in the office. They were younger women, typically of impeccable backgrounds, the girl-next-door types that I had learned to expect in the Bush White House. They handled hundreds of phone, fax, and mail requests for White House tours every day. The phones were constantly ringing. Though the visitor's office was one of the busiest places in the complex, the staff were poised and simply delightful. They were supposed to be. They had been carefully selected for their personalities. They dealt with thousands of citizens every week, many in high places. The staffing of this office had been high on the list of matters overseen by First Lady Barbara Bush. Among its other responsibilities, the visitor's office organized the many special and social events that occurred each year. The Christmas parties and tours, the staff's 4th of July celebration on the South Lawn, the annual Easter egg roll, and the president's helicopter arrivals and departures. Whenever an event took place in the residence or on the residence lawn, the visitor's office was responsible for making it work. They prepared the guest list, ordered the little American flags that everyone waved, and made sure everyone was cleared through the Secret Service. The visitor's office performed an important White House function, but it was only after the inauguration that Ms. Green contacted the office. Janet Johnson was happy to hear from anybody from the Clinton administration at that point, as the social business of the White House needed to continue. For example, contracts needed to be negotiated and signed for many coming events, including the Easter egg roll, which was looming on the horizon. The Easter egg roll is a tradition on the South Lawn of the White House. Children are invited to enjoy clowns, balloons, flags, surprises being given out at booths, a visit from the Easter Bunny, and the roll of the Easter eggs, a contest to get an egg from one point to another without breaking it. The Easter egg roll is one of the rare times average citizens get to enjoy the grounds of the White House. But entry is conditional. You must bring a child. Children love the Easter egg roll. To commemorate the event, each child is given a wooden egg with a picture of the White House on it. I took my own children to two of these celebrations. When Green presented herself at the visitor's office, she seemed impatient and in a hurry. She wanted a quick and easy summation of the office's work so that she could report back to Hillary for staffing decisions. Johnson tried to walk her through the various responsibilities and tried to impress on her the volume and importance of the work of the visitor's office. Green didn't seem interested or impressed. Johnson tried to bring Green up to speed, using the Easter egg roll as her best example of why the staffing of the office should be addressed soon. "Well, I don't think Hillary or Bill will care very much about this. Maybe we can cancel it. I just don't think they will want to do this egg thing." Johnson was astonished. "Hillary and Bill? First of all, Miss Green, we refer to the Clintons as Mr. President and the First Lady or Mrs. Clinton, not Hillary and Bill." "Well, I call them Hillary and Bill." "And in the second place, Miss Green," Johnson continued, "the Easter egg roll at the White House is an important tradition, one that is very famous. It has taken place here for many years. Most people have heard about it. Apparently you have not. Maybe before you dismiss its importance, you should talk to the President or Mrs. Clinton about it, because if you don't, in my opinion, you are making a serious mistake." According to Johnson, Green continued to dismiss the event, and the visitor's office overall, as inconsequential. Johnson could not fathom how such an immature person could have been placed in charge of evaluating the visitor's office, or any other White House function. Johnson's worst fears were in fact realized, as the Clintons, following Green's advice, botched the staffing of the visitor's office. When Janet Johnson told me this, I felt sorry for her and her staff. I knew they'd put their hearts into helping people see the White House and maintaining the high White House standards people expected. Now it looked like their work was being thrown away. I drove to Washington mid-morning on the day of the Easter egg roll. I saw unhappy parents and toddlers all over the place, many lined up past the entrance I usually used at the OEOB. The line stretched for hundreds of yards from the entrance gate. In years past, the event was over by noon. Why are they still here? I wondered. I soon found out. As I approached the gate, I overheard a young mother complaining to another mom, as both of their 4-year-olds screamed their lungs out. "Can you believe this? We've been waiting 4 hours now, and the line isn't moving. My kids are hungry, and there's no food. They're squirming, and they have no place to go to the bathroom. Can you believe these people? Don't they have kids? Don't they know kids get hungry, need to use bathrooms?" The other mom replied, "Man, I would never have come if I knew that it would be like this. It's supposed to be fun. This is a nightmare." And with that, she turned her stroller around and stomped off in the direction of the nearby McDonald's, where she could at least be assured of a snack for her child and a bathroom. What had happened? What went wrong? I asked my Secret Service buddy, whose officers had to pull extra duty during such events. "Damn Clintons. They can't do anything without screwing it up. We've got a mess from one end of the complex to the other, and hundreds of angry mothers. What the hell were they thinking? They simply won't listen. I told the new director of the visitor's office that they were setting it up all wrong. They invited too many people, left the gates open too long. Now they've closed the gates because the place is overrun, and they haven't even told the people in line yet. Wait until those tired and hungry moms and their children hear they've waited in line for nothing. I don't want to be here for that. And they've run out of eggs. Can you believe these people?" Although the event turned out to be a catastrophe, the news media made little mention of it. Janet Green didn't last very long at the White House, but not because of the Easter egg fiasco. Green worked for David Watkins, which was her bad luck. Rumors were rampant throughout the White House that Watkins discriminated against women. Watkins had already taken out Serda and Cornelius, his two deputies. They couldn't stand to be around him and moved to different posts. They had nothing kind to say about their former boss. Dennis told me that when he began to ask Watkins questions about Green for his background investigation of her, Watkins gave Dennis the timeout signal. "Why are you wasting your time on this case? I'm just going to fire Green anyway." "Why?" "Look, Dennis, you look like a bright guy and a man old enough to understand what I am about to say. But if you ever repeat what I'm going to tell you, I'll just deny it. Dennis, I'm going to fire Green for one reason and one reason only, and do you know what it is? I can't stand to work around women." Shortly afterward, Green was out the door. The Easter egg roll wasn't the only Clinton visitor's office disaster. Next came the 4th of July. I had planned to bring my kids down for the event, but at the last minute my boy came down with the flu, which turned out to be fortuitous. Things on the South Lawn got pretty ugly, according to some FBI agents who told me about it later. Apparently, someone took exception to the rule that only staff and their immediate family could attend. Since it would have been judgmental and controversial to define a family in this administration, each staff member was allowed to bring 4 guests. The Secret Service must have taken one look at the line winding around the White House that 4th of July night and collectively thought, "Oh, good grief." The diversity of Clinton families and guests meant a bigger crowd than the Secret Service could have expected or the grounds could accommodate. Before long, the South Lawn filled up, and there were people everywhere, even climbing the trees. The Secret Service didn't know what else to do besides close the gate early to stop the overcrowding. But then, all hell broke loose. The Clinton staffers and their friends shut outside simply climbed the fence. They broke into the White House. How dare the Secret Service ruin their evening? The Secret Service caught them, or at least most of them, and the invaders were promptly thrown to the ground and arrested, and rightly so. And then, later, they were unarrested. To my knowledge, not a single staffer was ever punished for this juvenile, outrageous, dangerous, and illegal act, Nor was a single guest prosecuted for breaking into the White House. Thus, another Clinton White House Visitor's Office fiasco passed quietly into the history books, unreported by the media. Has the performance of the Visitor's Office staff improved since these catastrophes? I'm told that although they work very hard to make the White House available to the public, it is not unusual for Bill, Hillary, or someone on their staff to decide at the last minute that it's time to party down. When that happens, hundreds of people who traveled hundreds or thousands of miles and who stand in line for hours to see the White House are greeted with a "Sorry, we're closed, come back another time" sign. At the beginning of the Christmas season, usually December 5th, the staff at the White House residence implements its holiday decorating theme. In order to create a first-class presentation, thousands of hours of work goes into the plan, at least 6 months' worth, and thousands of volunteers throughout the country participate in the making of tree ornaments for the many trees displayed in the White House and the residence. Many people in the arts, crafts, decorating industry participate to send in ornaments they hope will be good enough to hang on a White House tree. If the ornament is especially well made, there is a good chance it will be selected for the tree in the Blue Room, the First Lady's tree. The First Lady's tree is the mother of all trees, and the one that's supposed to capture the message of the First Lady herself. I was astonished when I was invited by the White House residence staff in 1992 under the Bush administration to help decorate the White House Christmas trees. I just couldn't believe it. I came home and told my wife, "Nina, there are only 40 people in the entire nation who are invited to do this, and I am one of the 40. Actually, I found out later that they didn't want me for my decorating talents, which was good, since I didn't have any. They wanted me because I had a strong back and the magic blue pass that allowed me to go anywhere in the White House. Decorating Saturday rolled around, and I arrived at dawn with everyone else. We sat in the residence near the formal dining room. The residence staff split us into teams and assigned us rooms, wreaths to hang, and trees to decorate. Most of my fellow decorators were professional florists. The decorating work, which was to last until 10:30 p.m., was organized with military precision. It was going to be the best decorated home in the world, or we would all collapse trying. That was the mood. This occasion was as close as I had ever worked with the resident staff, and my impression of them as hard-working, amazingly decent people was reinforced. This year's theme for the First Lady's Christmas tree was needlepoint, which was one of Barbara Bush's hobbies, and the place was filled with boxes of needlepoint ornaments. When we were done, late that night, we stood in silence and smiled, deeply satisfied. It was terrific. It was just breathtaking how beautiful the White House, and especially the First Lady's tree, had become, capturing the joy, the spirit of goodwill, even the religious meaning of the holiday season. It was one of the highlights of my time in the White House. Sure enough, in 1993, I was invited back to assist in hanging the Christmas decorations, but I declined. I was fed up with the attitude of the Clinton administration and its endless scandals. Just before decorating Saturday, I ran into some of my old team members from the previous Christmas. They were next to the Oval Office working on wreaths. None of them was cleared to be in this part of the complex. You needed a permanent pass. But then again, no one seemed to need clearance for anything anymore. "Gary, how are you doing? I hear you can't help us this year. Why not?" I made a flimsy excuse and avoided eye contact. "Well, don't feel too bad about it, pal. You aren't missing anything. You wouldn't believe what they're calling Christmas decorations this year. It's unbelievable. In fact, it's downright disgraceful. There's this one ornament, a clear lucite block, and inside are some old computer parts. And that's a Christmas ornament, see?" My other former team member chimed in. "Yeah, it's true. And there's all of this carved dark wood, not resembling much of anything, just sticks and twigs tied together. They look like fertility gods or something. We can't tell." "Yeah, and there are pots and carvings, some that look kind of obscene, and boxes, but nowhere can we find anything that resembles Christmas. Nowhere. And have you seen Bertha? Yes, I had seen Bertha, big ebony Bertha. Bertha was a statue that Hillary had selected to be placed along the public tour line. About 11 other examples of modern art were in the Jackie Kennedy Garden, the companion garden to the Rose Garden. Bertha was twice life-size and very naked. In addition, Bertha had enormous buttocks, far out of proportion to the rest of her body. That is why the permanent White House staff named her Bertha, which was short for Bertha's Big Butt. This is what the First Lady considered appropriate for the eyes of the thousands and thousands of visitors who daily toured the White House, Bertha's Big Butt. I could just hear my child asking, "Daddy, why doesn't that woman have any clothes on? Daddy, why is her bottom so big?" Later that same day, I drove to the Cannon House office building for some interviews. As I waited for a stoplight, I looked over at the National Christmas tree. What a sight it was! Gone were the multicolored Christmas balls and other ornaments that traditionally symbolized the holidays. Gone was the star from the top of the tree, symbolizing the night when Christ was born. Instead, on top of the tree was a large stainless steel ball pierced by colored shafts. It looked like the ball that sat atop the Daily Planet building in the Superman comic books I read as a child. This ball, and the square and triangle tinfoil ornaments, made the tree look like a robot. I couldn't wait to see what the Clintons and their friends would do the following year. When I returned to the White House the next day, I ran into Tom Hufford, one of the holdovers from the Bush administration, now working in the Office of Administration. Tom had worked very hard to convince the Clinton crowd that he was indeed apolitical, and I knew that he was. "Hi, Tom. What's up?" "Hi, Gary. How are you? Still here, I see." "Well, sort of, Tom. I don't spend much time here anymore. Most of my time is spent on the Hill talking to congressmen." "Did you want that?" "Yes, I did. I needed a change, a fresh perspective. I've been here long enough." "I think I know what you're getting at, Gary. I'm about ready to go myself." "Is your office still the place to pick up the Christmas cards?" "Yeah, if we ever get the cards made. We're about 2 weeks out, and they're still fighting over what kind of card, who's going to be on it, and so on and so forth." "Who's fighting about it?" "Gary, who do you think? The President and the First Lady. Who else?" "Right. Fighting over Christmas cards. How seasonal." The most noticeable thing about the Christmas cards when they arrived was that the First Family had lost Chelsea. She wasn't on the card. Maybe she was hiding in shame, because that Christmas the Los Angeles Times and the American Spectator ran their stories on Troopergate and the Clintons' extramarital escapades as Governor and First Lady of Arkansas. It wasn't the sort of news that those of us intent on preserving the reputation of the presidency wanted to hear. Fast forward to 1 year later. Again, I was asked to help decorate the White House. I didn't get it. There wasn't much to do. The Clintons didn't like tinsel. Not one tree had any tinsel. Nor was there any fake snow. Nor did there seem to be much for decorators to do. Christmas 1993 had been pretty stark. But then, it's always hard to hang wooden fertility symbols and lucite blocks with old computer parts. The branches keep bending and breaking. But I agreed to help. It might be a last chance to help the permanent staff with the decorations. I could see retirement up ahead, just 6 months out, and though I had loved working at the White House, the Clintons had made the idea of retirement particularly sweet for me. I arrived early. Everyone was in a good mood, but I was surprised to hear the First Family was at home. They had not gone to Camp David, as was traditional. That way, the decorating could go on undisturbed, and they could be surprised when they returned for the great unveiling. Perhaps Hillary didn't trust us. She had, in fact, hired some volunteers of her own. While in New York, Hillary had seen an office she thought was well decorated. She ordered the staff to find the decorators and bring them down. The permanent White House staff wasn't wild about this idea, but, after all, it was the First Lady's show. And everyone understood that it would be done the way Hillary Clinton wanted it done. Gary, you and your team will work on the Blue Room tree. What? I had been fired 2 years before from the Blue Room tree, the First Lady's tree, for complete decorative incompetence. They must have forgotten, I thought. I went out to unload a truck full of ornament boxes. They had been received at another location and then x-rayed and examined to make sure nobody sent the White House a ticking bomb. We brought the boxes into the hallway just north of the green, red, and blue rooms, between the state dining room and the east room. The GSA, the Park Service, and the residence maintenance staff had erected all the trees. Some staff were on high ladders hanging evergreen garlands. We gathered around folding tables to unpack the ornament boxes. It took about 10 seconds to get the first reaction. What in the world? Then another. What the hell? Then another. Look at this thing. What is it? Hillary's ornaments is what? From one end of the hall to the other, about 40 people were picking up these things, staring at them, turning them around, trying to figure them out or stifle their embarrassed laughter. I turned to one of my team members. What are these things? I heard the theme is the 12 days of Christmas, as interpreted by art students from around the country. Hillary sent a letter out just 2 months ago, really late, actually, asking budding artists to send in an interpretation of the 12 days of Christmas, and this is what they came up with. I couldn't believe what I was looking at. This stuff is just childish garbage. We can't hang this stuff on any White House Christmas tree. This is a bad joke. Gary, the orders from the First Lady's office are to hang these. It's what she wants, so we have to hang them. Anyway, many of them are from the Blue Ribbon Art Schools, as designated by the Secretary of Education. The whole administration has a stake in this. Well, if this is Blue Ribbon, then we're in serious trouble educationally. I pulled out one ornament that was 5 real onion rings. 5 golden rings, glued to a white styrofoam tray with a hook attached to the back so it could be hung. But where? Maybe in Bill Clinton's bedroom so he could rip off a midnight snack? I was disgusted, but some of it was actually pretty funny. Gary, come here, look at this. It was a mobile of 12 lords a-leaping. They were leaping, all right. The ornament consisted of tiny clay male figurines. Each was naked and had a large erection. My friend said, "Whoops," and he dropped it on the floor. Then, "Oh, no," as he stomped on it. He joked, "Man, I hope I don't get in trouble with Hillary for that." Some of the ornaments were silly, and some were dangerous, like the crack pipes hung on a string. We couldn't figure out what crack pipes had to do with Christmas, no matter how hard we tried, so we threw them back in the box. Some ornaments were constructed out of various drug paraphernalia, like syringes, heroin spoons, or roach clips, which are colorful devices sometimes adorned with bird feathers and used to hold marijuana joints. 2 turtle doves became 2 figurines that had the shells of turtles but the heads of birds. There were many of these. 4 calling birds were, you guessed it, birds with a telephone. And there were at least 2 miniature phone booths with 4 birds inside using the telephone. There was a partridge in a pear, without the tree, a clay pear with a partridge head sticking out of it. 3 French hens were French kissing in a ménage à trois. So many of the ornaments didn't celebrate Christmas as much as they celebrated sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Several of the birds had dark glasses and were blowing saxophones. "Hey, Gary, come over here." I walked over. It was another Leaping Lord's ornament. Each lord had a wooden body with a photograph of Rush Limbaugh for a head. 12 ditto heads, suitable for hanging. But nobody had the guts to hang Rush Limbaugh on Hillary's tree, so back in the box it went. First, though, I held the Limbaugh ornament up while someone took a picture of me. It was like holding 12 sticks of dynamite in my hand, because, with my bad luck, I expected one of the Clinton folks, or maybe the Clintons themselves, to walk around the corner just as the camera flash went off. But I was lucky this time. I went over to one of the tables I hadn't looked at yet. What's this? Of course. 2 turtle doves, but they didn't have shells this time. They were joined together in an act of bird fornication. I picked up another ornament that was supposed to illustrate 5 golden rings. One of the male florist volunteers grabbed my arm and laughed and laughed. "What's so funny? What are you laughing at?" "Don't you know what you're holding?" No, I didn't. But he was happy to explain it to me. The golden rings I was holding were sex toys known as cock rings, and they had nothing to do with chickens. Another mystery ornament was the gingerbread man. How did he fit into the 12 days of Christmas? Then I got it. There were 5 small gold rings I hadn't seen at first. One in his ear, one in his nose, one through his nipple, one through his belly button, and, of course, the ever-popular cock ring. I couldn't believe the disrespect that these ornaments represented. Many of the artists invited to make and send something to hang on the tree must have had nothing but disgust, hatred, and disrespect for the White House and the citizens of this country. A disgust obviously encouraged by the First Lady in the name of artistic freedom. I thought of all the children, grandmothers, and grandfathers walking past the White House's Blue Room, looking at the First Lady's Christmas tree, and wondering what in hell had possessed the White House. Here was another 5 golden rings ornament, 5 gold-wrapped condoms. I threw it in the trash. There were other condom ornaments, some still in the wrapper, some not. 2 sets had been blown into balloons and tied to small trees. I wasn't sure what the connection was to the 12 days of Christmas. Condoms in a pear tree? When we were through, the First Lady's tree had all the beauty and majesty of a landfill. Hillary's social secretary, Ann Stock, came down, carefully looked at the tree and its decorations, and pronounced it perfect and delightful. My shoulders sagged. Stock had been our last best hope to clean up this mistake, but instead she thought it was neat. At least we had turned the gingerbread man around so that his golden rings didn't face the tour line. I came back later and took some pictures of the tree and Mr. Gingerbread Man with rings side out. I knew nobody would believe this without photographic proof. While I was working on the tree, Craig Livingstone happened to stop by. He was surprised to see me placing ornaments on Hillary's tree, but I told him I was an old hand at this decorating business. Livingstone was leading Oliver Stone and Michael Douglas in a tour around the White House. Stone was making Nixon, and Douglas was making an American president. Stone looked stoned to me as he gazed around, obviously thinking of this shot or that. I wasn't impressed. Still, this must have been a great moment for Livingstone, our White House security director, whose goal in life was to become a Hollywood producer. But the cameras, surprisingly enough, soon fell not on Michael Douglas, or on the dazed Oliver Stone, or the photogenically challenged Craig Livingstone. They fell on me. I was interviewed by Martha Stewart, who was doing a Christmas special to be aired later on a major network morning show. She promised she would not blow my cover when she learned I was an FBI agent. As she looked around the tree, she made "hmm" sounds. If she didn't like the tree, she was very diplomatic about it. I wondered what she really thought. It seemed to me most people could have only one thought: throw a tarp over it. Aside from displaying sex toys and self-mutilation devices on the nation's Christmas tree, there was another change in the way the White House celebrated Christmas. Hillary decided to delete spouses from the invitation-only staff Christmas party. This caused a bit of a stir, not only because it broke with tradition, but because it raised a question I had heard several permanent staffers ask. Why is Hillary so hostile to families? I think it's because they represent a sphere of loyalty outside her control, and Hillary likes to be in charge. Chapter 7. Drugs. Rules for Radicals. Men don't like to step abruptly out of the security of familiar experience. They need a bridge to cross from their own experience to a new way. A revolutionary organizer must shake up the prevailing patterns of their lives, agitate, create disenchantment and discontent with the current values, to produce, if not a passion for change, at least a passive, affirmative, non-challenging climate. George Washington's Rules of Civility and Decent Behavior. Let your recreations be manful, not sinful. It was Sunday morning, 4 December 1994. I was sitting at my kitchen table drinking a cup of coffee and watching Newt Gingrich being interviewed for Meet the Press. It was assumed that Congressman Gingrich would be the next Speaker of the House when the new Republican-controlled 104th Congress convened in January. I nodded in agreement when Gingrich said the Clintons and their staff were throwbacks to the 1960s counterculture. Then, to drive his point home, he said, I had a senior law enforcement official tell me that many Clinton White House staffers had used illegal drugs within the past 5 years. I choked and spit my coffee across the table. There couldn't be more than 24 senior law enforcement officials who could have told Newt Gingrich about White House drug use, and some people would think that I was one of them. My first thought was, there goes my job. I was not an official, but I was law enforcement, and I was senior. I was also assigned to both the White House and the House of Representatives. Craig Livingstone knew about my bifurcated assignment at the White House and the U.S. House of Representatives. Livingstone had quizzed me before about who might be talking to Congress about Clinton White House shenanigans. And the Clintons controlled the Department of Justice under Janet Reno and the FBI. I would be at the top of the Clintons' short list of suspected whistleblowers. Even though I hadn't leaked anything, I was likely finished. They had a perfect excuse to fire me. Gingrich hadn't completed his interview before I received my first, "Did you hear what Gingrich just said?" phone call. I received calls all day, Sunday and Monday, from fellow agents, friends, and family who were worried for me. I assured them all that I was not Gingrich's buddy. But if my own friends thought Gingrich was referring to me, how much more would the Clinton administration see this as their opportunity to put me out to pasture? Of course, I knew that there were probably multiple leaks, and it would not have surprised me to learn that many law enforcement officials in the FBI, the Secret Service, and elsewhere were complaining to Congress or anyone else who would listen about the Clinton White House staff and executive branch political appointments. Monday passed, and nothing happened. On Tuesday morning, however, Livingstone asked me to come down to see him as soon as I could. Livingstone said, "Gary, I just hung up with your director. I told Free that I didn't believe you were the leak." He was watching me closely for a reaction, but I gave him none. "Gary, do you know who is telling Congress all this shit about drugs and stuff?" "Craig, look, I don't know. Nobody, anybody, everybody. You should know by now that you can't hide anything in this town, especially in this White House. I've told you that before. There are dozens of people who might be in a position to comment on drug use on the part of your staff. Drug use has not been my main concern, and you know that." "Well, okay. Listen, on another topic, I've been wondering what you're going to do after you retire. Made any plans yet? You said you were going to retire soon. I'm just curious." No, Craig, I really haven't made any plans. I might go into the private investigations business. I don't know. I guess I have to start thinking about that." Our conversation had suddenly taken a very puzzling turn. "Well, would you consider taking over George's place? You know, be the White House security consultant?" I was shocked. From suspected leak to employee of the month, all in one conversation. "Craig, I can't say yes or no, but I'll consider it. Have you checked with, the higher-ups around here to see if that would be okay with them?" I believe Craig knew that I was referring to Hillary Clinton, since Craig had already told me that she called the shots on security. "Yes, yes, don't worry about that. You're trusted. It's a done deal. Just think about that, okay?" "Okay, I will. But where is George going? Has he announced his retirement?" George hadn't indicated to me that he had any interest in leaving, and, in fact, he seemed to be content with his new, if very limited, role. "No, he doesn't know anything about this. He's, getting old, and, well, I think it's time for George to retire." I was dumbstruck. As I pondered what Livingstone had just said, I began to wonder. I thought, nah, he can't be offering me a promise of a job to silence me because he thinks I'm the leak. A job to shut me up? No way. That's too obvious. Yet I remembered that the Clinton administration had offered jobs to some of the state troopers in Little Rock after they started talking to the press about the personal and professional problems the Clintons had had while Bill was governor. In one case, a trooper was contacted directly by the President of the United States, and he had indeed become a federal employee, earning a salary of almost $100,000 a year.